This device is picking up in a point and moving out.
The first internet station in history.
How could that be?
Cyber Station USA.
Can you give me an image that helps me grasp that?
Ladies and gentlemen,
the Fairness Doctrine, left-right radio for the radical center.
I'm Chuck Morse.
I'm Patrick O'Heffernan.
And, of course, the caliber of guests we're getting quite used to having in this program.
I really do enjoy this new platform.
Hello, sports fans.
Hi.
Intelligent conversation.
I'm on the conservative side.
Oh, boy.
The Fairness Doctrine starts right now on CyberStationUSA.com.
Hello, America. Chuck Morse co-hosting The Fairness Doctrine, left, right, and uncensored, Monday through Friday, 1 to 3 p.m., here at CyberStation USA Radio Network, emanating out of Quincy Square in Massachusetts. I'd like to welcome aboard my co-host, Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan, coming in from Los Angeles. Patrick, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. This is an interesting week, going to be an interesting show today. We have two great guests, Frank Schaefer, in the first hour on his hilarious and dangerous book, Sex, Mom, and God. And, of course, in the second hour, Tom Palkin is going to talk about the Republican presidential lineup, which is getting very interesting.
What is the name of Tom's last book, Patrick?
Oh, you know what? I just was looking at that, and it was
Bringing
America Home, How America Lost Her Way and How We Can Find Our Way Back.
Okay, yeah, he's pretty good. Yeah, We've had him on before.
He's a native Texan, as am I.
Yep.
And he was national chairman of college Republicans in the anti-Vietnam protest. He was one of the people who didn't like me in those years.
Right. Patrick, I noticed that the vote took place in the Congress last night with regard to the issue that you and I and Dave Johnson were talking about, the raising of the debt ceiling.
Right. That
you
was pretty much
that.
Sort of a symbolic vote. Both parties were trying to get the other party in the position where they could run attack ads against them later. It didn't really mean much.
How many? Do we have a roll call of who voted for that? Which
no,
was less than 100, I think.
I think you could, yeah, that because the Democrats, the Democratic leadership advised Democrats not to vote for it, because that would be used against them later on. And, of course, the Republicans had their leadership guidance, too. So, yeah, it was...
I wonder who did vote for it, though. It would be a very interesting list to kind of mull over.
Well, why don't we ask Anna if she can find that for us. Anna, could you look up who actually voted for the debt relief bill last night?
Now, Patrick, Dave was very serious about viewing this as a good idea. That I mean, everyone knows that the debt ceiling will have to be raised, but this idea that somehow there shouldn't be any accompanying cutback in government, and that there was something, you know, he referred to any opposition to that as hostage, as holding it hostage. I mean, which I think, you know, this is how Congress operates. They don't just steamroll things through. You know, I mean, at least they're not supposed to. We'd rather they don't, even though they just did with the USA Patriot Act. I mean, it's a good thing that there are debates. That's usually how things are done in a democratic system. But you brought up the counterpoise that perhaps Congress should raise taxes. So I guess that, I don't know, you know, it was a very cacophonous conversation, but my comment on that was that I suppose if there's a congressman out there that wants to raise taxes, they should submit that for a vote. It would be very interesting to see who votes for that. And it would be very interesting to see if something like that passed, if Barack Obama would sign it.
Well, first of all, there's a couple of nuances here. Dave's point, and I agree with him on this, is that Congress has established a budgeting process, and that is generally when the issues of taxes and budget size, et cetera, get done. And they don't get done normally in votes for debt response and things like that. And that because the House leadership, which is Republican, decided to try to do it at this particular juncture, what they were trying to do is to hold the Democrats, not the Democrats, but rather hold the nation's economy hostage, saying if they don't get their way, they're going to crash the world's economy. His argument was that we should either vote the debt ceiling extension up or down on its own merits and then move on to the budget process in which the House Budgeting Committee and Ways and Means, et cetera, hold their hearings and we go through the regular process. Now, obviously, the leadership can do what they darn well please, and they did, but his point was that trying to hold the world economy hostage because Republicans want their way is not really a good way to do business. And
well,
the result was it got voted down, and now we
right. And I don't know if I'd portray it that the world economy. If anything, I think that some budget cuts along with the debt increase would help the national economy. I don't know about the rest of the world, as opposed to just raising $1 trillion more in debt without any evidence that we've cut the government's cut any other aspects. I think that would have probably hurt the economy. I would argue. Anyway, why don't we have to go and I hear the fanfare. We'll introduce our beloved affiliates. We'll be right back.
Use the old ways with the best ways of doing those things forever.
The future of radio.
Yeah, we're there, sunshine.
Cyber Station USA.
We're there.
.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
this is the Fairness Doctrine. I'm Chuck Morse.
I'm Patrick O'Heffernan. Welcome to college.
Cyber Station USA Radio Network.
The Fairness Doctrine, left-right radio for the radical center.
Patrick's on the authoritarian left. I'm on the conservative side.
This is the world we live in.
The stage was set for a battle that would pit friend against friend and neighbor against neighbor.
We have a glassed-in studio here.
What we're talking about is a balance back and forth.
Political points have been issued. This whole sun is apple pie and motherhood.
Right, left, it doesn't really matter.
Look
at the politics,
the issues, and the
culture.
It's like a
civil war
within the community. There's no question.
You're just going to be everywhere.
So here they are, ready to go for broke, right by your side.
Fairness Doctrine starts right now.
Cyber Station USA Radio Network.
The Fairness Doctrine, left, right, and uncensored. This is yours truly, Chuck Morse, along with Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan, Monday through Friday, 1 to 3 p.m., here at Cyber Station USA Radio Network. I'd like to welcome aboard our affiliate stations, WDIS AM 1170 in Norfolk, Massachusetts, 1490 WWPR in Bradenton, Florida, and KRKQ FM in Ashland, Oregon. And of course, let me welcome aboard my co-host, Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan. Patrick, how are you?
I'm doing well, and also like to welcome our intern, Anna, Anna Pickrell, who has sent us a list of those who voted yay and nay on the president's request to increase the statutory limit on the public debt.
Yes, we're talking about last night's vote to raise the debt ceiling. Patrick, just before we get to that, I don't really agree with you that this was just some kind of a symbolic measure. And I say that because I've been listening to left-wing radio this past week, and they have been pumping this thing like I can't believe. And I'm not sure they thought it through. It was more, I don't even think Dave, with due respect to Dave Johnson, our usual correspondent, I'm not sure he really thought this through either. It was more almost just a cheerleading thing. I mean, the Democrats want this, so it must be good. I think this is kind of a no-brainer if you take a look at it. It should be nonpartisan. It should be a look at what is the best thing to do. Do you just raise the debt ceiling by a couple of $1 trillion and forget it without anything attached? Or do you tell the world economy or the national economy that our government is going to be taking measures that is going to, ensure that the thing could be balanced and that the currency will be preserved somewhat? Wall Street will be reassured. I know we don't like that word, but nevertheless, you know, that's where people's money is. And other measures. To me, this is really a matter of economy. I mean, if you're going to raise a debt ceiling, it seems to make sense that you do at least something to show that the government is trimming in certain areas. And apparently a lot of Democrats agree. But why don't we go to the list?
Well, it's a long list, but let me point out that raising the debt ceiling on a straight up and down vote does not preclude increasing revenue or decreasing expenditures. Like I said, there is a congressional process for doing that, and raising the debt ceiling doesn't mean you actually have to take on that debt. All it means is that you have signaled the world markets that we are going to pay our bills, that this is not going to be a problem. And interestingly enough, CNN, after the vote, reported back, and they had a number of Republican congressmen there who agreed with them, that as soon as the vote was taken, the Republican leadership got on the phone to the major banks the heads of the major banks in Wall Street and said, "Don't worry, we're going to pass it. Don't worry, don't put out the word that the economy's bad. This is just the first step." So,
well, that's reassuring because they're watching this thing and they're looking for some level of stability. And, you know, yes, you're right, they're not going to necessarily spend all the money, but it's like getting an increase on a credit card. No, they may not spend it all today.
But not necessarily.
Well, not necessarily.
And in fact, now we'll then go into the budgeting process, which is where it'll take place. And keep in mind that there's two sides to the budget. There's revenue as well as expenditures, and the Republicans said, we're not going to increase revenue, even though 80% of the of America's public want revenue increased on the wealthy and corporations. So if you say the Democrats are being stubborn because they won't cut the budget, which is not true, they have already cut the budget, and in fact, the new budget that the president approved a few months ago had $6 billion worth of cuts in it, so the Democrats have already said they will cut the budget. It's the Republicans who are being pig-headed and stubborn and risk it. They're saying, we will not increase taxes on anybody anyway, etc., including oil companies. Sorry, this is a democracy. You compromise, you find what works. You just don't stick by your ideological guns and say, the hell with the rest of the country. We're going to get our way, or we're going to take our marbles and go, and the rest of you can go bankrupt, which is what the Republicans are saying.
Patrick,
so
as I said, when the credit card balance was advanced,
when
a credit card company gives you an advance on a credit card, they ask you, you've already talked for 10 minutes. When a credit card company gives you an advance on a credit card, they usually ask you how you're going to be paying it back and by what means. And also, as I said in the beginning, Patrick, if the Democrats want to raise taxes, let them present a bill and let's see who votes for it. And let's see if Obama signs it. Fine. Go ahead. Go ahead. Right? Anyways, we're going to go to a break.
Capitol Hill Insight is a radio program outlined and designed to talk about the comings and goings of our men and women on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., brought to you by GradeGov.com. Capitol Hill Insight is aired twice weekly, Monday at 7 p.m. and again on Friday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It really is the wave of the future. CyberStation USA Radio Network is a worldwide broadcasting system.
The whole world is under attack. We're
about to hit the bank of tyrants. Your feelings on CyberStation USA.
Worldwide broadcasting system.
Each and every Monday night, deep house, aggressive percussion, jazz funk, lounge, funk, film scores.
This man is a masterclass.
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before.
He's
obsessive. You can say anything you want, but you better say anything. Say yes.
The UFOs, the things that go bump in the night.
I actually get goosebumps.
I think it's very, very important work.
This is Don Eckert, host of Duck Matters Radio, heard right here on CyberStation USA.
I do believe the government is covering something up.
I know what I experienced is real.
Why they're here, where they're from, you can only speculate.
Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. until midnight Pacific time on CyberStation USA.
An executive order doesn't have the force of law, ladies and gentlemen. It is simply a paper tiger.
Mike Siegel, 3 p.m. weekdays on CyberStationUSA.com.
866-738-3535. 1400. Anybody who wants to call, feel free to do it. Make this a town forum, if you will.
And in a democracy, you can only ignore the will of the people for so long and get away with it.
We're glad to get your calls on this program at 866-738-1400, toll free. We will see what happens.
This is Rare Power to Rearrange the Blueprint of Life. This is CyberStationUSA.com.
You are listening to The Fairness Doctrine on the CyberStation USA Radio Network. Patrick, take it away.
Well, actually, it's Chuck's hosting today,
Patrick.
But we have a guest with us that I'm really happy about, so I'll introduce him and turn it over to Chuck. We have with us Frank Schaefer, and he's the author of the New York Times best-selling Keeping Faith and the memoir Crazy for God, and many other novels, including Portofino. But we're going to talk about his new book. His new book is Sex, Mom, and God, which to me is one of the most hilarious and dangerous books out today. Chuck, take it away.
Thank you, Patrick. Thanks for joining us, Frank.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Frank, you've been on the inside of the Protestant conservative religious movement. You grew up in it, and I've broadcasted on conservative stations. So I have a couple of questions for you that might seem like somewhat of a technical matter.
Sure.
But you're the perfect person, perhaps, to clear this up. What's the difference between a premillennialist and a postmillennialist?
Well, May 21st came and went, and we're all still here. So, you know, the premillennial, postmillennial debate is one of these crazy how many angels can dance on the head of a pin deals about whether everyone will be raptured before the tribulation when things get bad and the Antichrist takes over, or whether believers like everybody else just have to grin and bear it and wait for the end of the earth and take their lumps along with the unsaved and the heathen until Jesus comes back. So the folks who believe they're all going to be raptured to heaven are either premillennial or postmillennial. I get it mixed up. And the ones that don't are the other. And
right.
So it's one of these deals that no one ought to care about until you realize that, you know, a third of Republican voters in New Jersey seriously contend that Barack Obama is the Antichrist. And then, you know, the joke gets a little less funny because you've got a whole swath of the American public, you know, the kind of unwashed rube mob, if you want to put it that way, who literally take this stuff seriously enough so they'd actually argue the point, split a seminary or start a whole new church if you disagreed with them on it, and think you're probably going to hell if you had the wrong opinion. So, yeah, it's an interesting place to start a discussion about sex, mom, and God, but on the other hand, it's a good point because, as you just saw, this media frenzy about the end of the world was about all this, and you know, most people that you might know or I might know took it as a bit of a joke, but there's a big chunk of America that doesn't, and those votes count. They put people like George W. Bush in the White House and keep them there for 8 years, so it matters.
Well, first of all, I think that I'm not Christian, by the way, but I think that Christianity is one of the books that it embraces is the Book of Revelations, and that that's Christianity, including mainstream Christianity, does believe that there's going to be an end times. I think that what we're talking about here are some people who debate whether it's going, you know, whether it's going to lead to the millennial age or whether the millennial
right.
age is going to happen first. And that, to my way of thinking, that tends to be somewhat of a theological question. And I like to stay out of theological questions unless people are flying airplanes into the World Trade Center. Then I get interested.
Then it gets interesting.
That's
but,
fine.
You know, unfortunately, we've got our own version of the kind of people that fly airplanes into World Trade Centers. Literally, when you look at groups like the Hatari Militia, whose whole premise was based on the fact that they felt called to take up weapons and fight the U.S. government as part of the end-time scenario of the return of Christ. So, you know, it gets all very real too quickly, whether it's radical Islamic forces or whether it's radicalized right-wing American Christians. It comes from the same kind of place, which is essentially to refuse to live in reality and be bound by fact.
Okay, well, as I said, I think that end times is part of mainstream Christianity. Catholicism embraces it as well. Now, I don't know much about the Hatari militia, but I don't think that they're to be compared to the international Islamic conspiracy. I mean,
no, they aren't in terms of their effectiveness.
Right.
But on the other hand,
numbers.
On the other hand, when you've got people who have been selling bumper stickers from Psalm 109 asking God to, answer prayers to make our president's life shorter. And if you go to the next verse in the psalm, make his wife a widow and his children fatherless. There are some people in our culture who would call themselves Christians, and there's a lot of them who have demonstrated both through the way they've been voting, as I talk about in the book, but also just what their interests are in terms of theology, that these points to them are not arcane theoretical discussions to have over a cup of coffee.
But there's a little difference, Frank, and that is, and I reject that whole idea of calling for anybody's death. But
sure,
they're not hijacking airplanes and flying them into the White House. I mean, they may be. You know, I've heard this argument made, for example, with regard to some people who call themselves Christian Zionists, and I happen to be Jewish, by the way.
Right.
And that they want to see the Jews gather into Israel because then there are going to be these things that are going to happen and that God is going to kill them all and then the Messiah will come. I don't believe any of that. If I did, I'd be Christian. But the point is, I also don't think that there's any harm done with it because they're not actually calling for anybody to actually be killed. This comes down to, a belief system that, to my way of thinking, unless you want to talk about some really far right-wing fringe
right.
group that really, I don't know if they've actually done anything violent, we could talk about that. But putting that aside, this is really more of a belief issue. And generally speaking, the path that I think they lay out to get to their end times, as far as I can tell, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is to do good deeds, to be, to try to, in their own way, be right with God, regardless of how misguided that path may be to, and we probably both agree it is, but, the intentions are good. Like, even this business of this millennial guy, who I think was probably a fraud, nevertheless, first of all, it was not mainstream Christianity because Jesus said in the New Testament that only God knows when the end times are going to come. So we know that, and for that reason, I don't think that anyone but a handful of people embraced it, the same type of people that would have embraced Jimmy Jones and the Guyana group, which was a far left-wing group. But the point is that even in that context, their path toward the end times was to try to do good deeds. I mean,
well,
it was a shame.
Well, not in the case of George W. Bush, who, by the way, I knew personally growing up. He used to visit the Ministry of Labrie that I write about in Sex, Mom, and God. And when Barbara, his mom, called my mom after he was running for president, Mom said, "Are you sure you got the right Bush brother right? Because Barbara used to call me and say, pray especially for him because he's clueless as to what he wants to do. You must mean Jeb." And, I knew these people growing up, and I still know them. In fact, I've got a folder of handwritten notes from the Bush family, both back into my dad's time and also of my own from when I was an activist on the religious right. George W. thought he was an instrument of God going into Iraq. And so that's far from an old guy doddering around in California protecting the end times, both because he's a Christian Zionist and thought he was thereby supporting Israel, but also because he felt that somehow he had been called to protect America after 9/11 and that he would lash out and declare a war on Iraq that had absolutely nothing to do with this issue. And if you take away his evangelical belief in his special call, exactly the same sort of thing that Michelle Bachmann talks about, Sarah Palin, this feeling that they've been called by God especially to lead the country, you have a very different presidency. So, I think in the case of George W. Bush, it was a long way from an esoteric, theological, harmless discussion. You do have people in American public policy who have a very fundamentalist view of their Christian faith and who act upon it, and George W. was one of them, and one of the reasons we were in Iraq is he felt that somehow he had been called by God to A, protect Israel, and went along with the whole neoconservative movement on that, and B, that he was going to not only finish what his dad had started, but that somehow this fit in with making the world safer for the Christian Western ethos that he was defending as God's chosen. And, that's not far-fetched. I happen to know Franklin Graham, who, quote-unquote, led George W. to the Lord, and Franklin Graham's running around not only making a lot of anti-gay statements, but also making all kinds of very radicalized anti-Islamic statements, et cetera, et cetera. Some of these people are not so peripheral, and they're not just as harmless. On the other hand, I totally agree with you. In the book, one of the things I do in Sex, Mom, and God is try to actually humanize through looking at my mother and what a good and decent life she lived, how compassionate she was on people, going to show that actually in the mainstream evangelical world, the people who have intended to lead it in a more radical direction have actually been betraying, I think, the better elements of the, not just the Christian tradition, but specifically even American evangelicalism, even conservative evangelicalism I disagree with. And I just don't think that, you know, everybody can be lumped into the same category, but I also don't think that it's all innocuous and it's all just a matter of personal belief. I think it's done real damage to the American political system, having a religious right that's been beating the drum for this American exceptionalist idea, this idea that somehow we're chosen by God to fulfill a destiny in the world, very much mirroring what the Puritans said about the Bay State Colony.
That's right.
And when it gets to people like George Bush, it has led to real trouble and a war that we fought in. By the way, having a son who was a Marine who fought over there, this got very personal.
You know, Frank, I understand your personal feelings about a policy that deposed Saddam Hussein, and I think you and I could debate that on a political plane and on a religious plane. But there are people who differ on that, both people on the right and on the left who are opposed to it. People like me felt, and Joe Lieberman and Hillary Clinton apparently, felt that it was a just war. But putting that aside, I think that most American presidents, including President Barack Obama, who prays publicly, has said that they believe that there is a kind of an exceptionalism to the United States, and I believe that, and that they believe that there's a certain greater calling involved in leading this country. I don't think that there's anything particularly sinister about that, and if anything, I think that it's a preferable belief to those who worship earthly government and who want to collectivize the world. But let me welcome in my co-host, Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan. Patrick?
Thank you, Chuck. Well, as I said at the beginning of the segment here, I think this is one of the funniest and also scariest books that I have read in a long time, and also I think one of the most informative in that it really lays out the facts on myths and pseudo-myths that have been floating around a long time. So I want to congratulate you on this book. This is marvelous.
I appreciate that.
And I have to say, I began laughing with the first sentence in the prologue. I want to move a little bit deeper into the book, and you kind of lay out your thesis here, and you say, the problem isn't sex. It's unconstrained capitalism combined with the reaction to a nutty religion and appealing to the lowest common denominator in a society where the market rules is the 11th commandment. Is that a good summary of the thesis you're laying out here, or did I miss something like your mother?
No, I think actually it's a great summary, and the only thing I'd add is that this book can be read on several layers. Obviously, it's the story of my mother, who I hold up as an example of someone who, as I put it in the book, was a lot better person than her theology. It's also a look at our society, and in terms of that aspect of the book, I think the line you chose there represents it perfectly.
Well, as you get into the book, it kind of evolves as you evolve, because this is sort of the story of your growing up, with your mother's very frank talks about sex with you, to how that interacts with our political and religious society. So I wonder if you could explain what the strange view of sex is in evangelical Christianity, or what the Catholics call the pelvic issues, and how that has affected their view of the world. I think the way you put it is they try to shove the way they want the world to be into the way it actually is, or vice versa.
Yeah.
What's the problem with this? Why can't people just have these crazy ideas about sex?
Well, you know, in Sex, Mom, and God, what I do is I use my life as a lens, as a mirror. The book is not primarily about me in that sense, but since I lived in an evangelical fundamentalist home and grew up there, I talk from the inside about the subject as well as look at all the political ramifications of what it produced. And, of course, it all starts with those bedtime Bible stories. And, you know, if they were being offered in children's stores, everybody in the store would either be arrested or fired. But because they're in the Bible and it's a holy book, you can take a Bronze Age myth about God, quote-unquote, commanding the Israelites to slaughter all the Canaanites in a passage where Moses is reprimanding them because they spared some women and children. He says, no, kill them all, but you can keep the virgins for yourself. You have that kind of in the scriptures towards the beginning of these Bronze Age myths that have been held up as a holy book. And it goes from there and runs all the way through the New Testament. It isn't a question of, you know, the Old Testament's mean and the New Testament's nice. The Old Testament is mean, but so is the New Testament. You have plenty in there going all the way up through the book of Revelation where everybody's eyes are melting in their sockets if they're not being taken to heaven, etc. It's a bloodthirsty book full of revenge, but a lot of the revenge, if you really read it, is directed against women who anytime they screw up get killed. For instance, if they don't sit in their tent for 7 days when they're menstruating or have the misfortune to lose their virginity before their wedding and they're stoned to death in their father's gate, as is commanded in the book of Leviticus, etc. What you unpack pretty soon there is a misogynistic mythology that has really done incredible harm to individuals. It's, if you look, for instance, at the fact that the way women are treated today, say in Afghanistan, and realize that for the better part of Western history, women didn't fare much better in our own culture, and indeed in big chunks of it still don't. You have to see that it isn't just a series of technical or theological issues that don't affect people. It's had a tremendous impact first on women, on gay people, on anybody different. That doesn't even get into the lives that have been individually harmed by people trying to live consistent with something that's impossible to live according to, which is this sort of anti-sexuality that's come through the Roman Catholic Church, all the way to the point where sex is even seen as a punishment of women in multiple conceptions, and you ban birth control because it's not in the spirit of the book of Genesis that said Eve and her descendants would be punished by multiple conception and difficulty in childbirth. You know, touch it where you want. If it wasn't a holy book, quote unquote, it would be something you'd never read to anybody under 18, and with great care thereafter in case of the damage it would do. And I think the same goes for the Quran. The same goes for all our so-called holy books, most of which are rooted back into Bronze Age mythology that came out of various sources.
Okay,
so,
Frank, we have to take a brief break. It has real results,
and that's what the book tries to unpack.
Frank, I'm going to hold you right there. Frank Schaeff is our guest. Sex, Mom, and God. We'll be right back.
We're there, sunshine. We're there.
Greetings.
Hey, who said that?
That would be me, sir. And I'm down here.
Whoa.
Did you know that with Greyhound super friendly fares, you can travel to thousands of places in the U.S. starting at just $49 when you plan ahead?
Well, I gotta say, like, I'm in total disbelief here.
What's not to believe, sir? Greyhound fares have always been friendly on your wallet.
Oh, no, man, that's not what.
What is it then?
You're a dog.
You can't trust a cat to handle a mission like this, sir.
Special conditions apply. Call Greyhound for details.
I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called the Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question, but there's only one place. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Catch us weekdays at 6 p.m. on CyberStationUSA.com.
The whole world is under attack. We're
passing the Bangkok Silence. Your feelings on CyberStation USA.
Worldwide broadcasting system.
Each every Monday night, Deep House. Progressive percussion, jazz funk, lounge, funk, film scores.
This man is a master craftsman.
I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like this before.
He's obsessive.
You can say anything you want, but you better say anything. Say yes.
From UFOs to things that go bump in the night.
I actually get goosebumps.
I think it's very, very important work.
This is Don Eckert, host of Dark Matters Radio, heard right here on CyberStation USA.
I do believe the government is covering something up.
I know what I experienced is real.
Why they're here, where they're from, you can only speculate.
Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. until midnight Pacific time on CyberStation USA.
This is Rare Power to Rearrange the Blueprint of Life.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
You're listening to The Fairness Doctrine on the CyberStation USA radio network with Chuck Morris and Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan. Chuck, take it away.
Thank Laws, and our guest is Frank Schaefer, Sex, Mom, and God. Frank, you're involved in a vicious attack on the Word of God. Now, having said that, I will point out that there is one area I might agree with you, is that the Protestant fundamentalists have a tendency, at least those on the far right, have a tendency to look at the Bible in such a manner that it doesn't lend itself to, I wouldn't say interpretation, but I would say commentary, whereas in Catholicism and in my religion, Judaism, we have a Talmud, and in Catholicism they get cardinals, who basically bring the Torah or the Bible and the message that's contained in it and apply it to practical life today. And but what happens sometimes, I think, with some Protestant sects is that they just swallow the thing whole and they don't look at the context in which these things are meant. And I don't agree with that. I do think that's dangerous, I suppose, even though there are no Midianites or Amalekites today. But I think that the result of that is that there's a grave misinterpretation when you look at these things literally. And it actually is dangerous to look at them literally. There have been Jewish sects who have tried to do this, and they have been heretical. They've been kicked out of Judaism for good reason.
Well, you know, you and I do agree on this. And I would just say, as you know, in the Jewish tradition, as if you use a generality like the Roman Catholics or the Jews believe this or the Protestants believe that, as you know very well, there's a huge difference between various branches of Reform Judaism, conservative Orthodox groups, Hasidic. Just the same thing applies within the Protestant community.
Right.
Obviously, there's a huge range, you know, from kind of progressive Episcopalian and United Methodists all the way down through, you know, some little home Bible church that was started last Wednesday by someone who split from everybody else because he or she believed they were the only people who had the truth. And the Roman Catholic Church is no different. You know, it's not a monolithic structure. You have ultra-conservatives on the right, like Professor George from Princeton, who, you know, is an advisor to the more conservative Roman Catholic bishops, all the way to groups that are completely out of sync with the papacy and so forth. So, you know, one of the things I try to do in Sex, Mom, and God is point out that speaking in generalities about these groups just doesn't do. So we have to look at specifics. And within my own tradition, which comes out of that Protestant background, if you look at, for instance, the Reconstructionists, people like Rusess Rushdoony, Gary North, and the others, they not only took and make this effort to take the Bible literally, but actually call for the imposition of Levitical law today in North America in a way that no Jewish group that I know would do, no Roman Catholic group would do, and they've had a significant amount of influence. For instance, you know, laughable as it seems, they think we ought to have the death penalty for homosexuality again, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm not saying they're about to take over the world or that we're in any grave danger from these people specifically, but when you watch the radicalization and the gradual shift to the right of the whole evangelical movement in America, it does represent millions of people, and a shift to the right makes a difference not only politically, but in the way they view other people of other faiths, amongst other things.
Yeah, but I think that, look, I don't want to be misinterpreted here either. What I started by saying is that I think that you're condemning the Holy Word of God at the same time. The rabbis who interpret the Torah, the bishops that interpret the New Testament, they're not changing it. What they're doing is that they are applying the morality of it in a context that is applicable today. They're not going through a literal interpretation of it. They're making it livable while at the same time they're recognizing the divine nature of it. And, you know, you talk about Rusess Rushdoony bringing back death penalties for gays. I'm not for that. But at the same time, the Bible does say certain things about homosexual activity that you can't get around.
Well, I can get around it very easily by saying, so what? I mean, who says the Bible's the Word of God anyway? A and B, who says that you got to take it all in, as one piece of cloth and either sink or swim with the whole thing? And the last question is this. If there is a God out there, and there may be, I happen to believe there is on most days. Some days I'm an agnostic, as any reasonable person would be, because we all have doubts and interests. But who says God even likes the Bible or is defined by it? Maybe it's an unauthorized biography, and if there was a court somewhere, he'd sue.
Well,
because it's,
you know,
certainly
again,
very
Frank,
bad
we're getting
for God.
Into.
It's God's for very bad for God's image, if there is a creator, to be linked to this insane book. It has some wonderful things in it. It also has some absolute loony things in it. Just crazy that taken in any context would be a blasphemy. Look, if somebody wrote a book about me and said that I had done the things that the Bible says God did, I'd sue them.
Yeah, but you're not God. And the
fortunately, because if the Bible is a description of God, then God is the devil.
You're very anti Judeo-Christian faith.
That's absolutely untrue. I go to church every Sunday. I'm very pro Judeo-Christian when it comes to the tradition,
but
I'm not pro the Bible, and there's a difference.
All right,
I'll
accept that difference. I would contend that the Bible, the Torah, is the font of both the Judaic and Christian faith, and you're against it.
I am against it, it's time to separate the idea of faith, spirituality, and religion from the holy books, period. Not just the Bible, the Quran, the Torah, the whole bit. Why should we be bound by these books?
That's your opinion. I think we need to adhere to the Bible, both Old and New Testament, because I believe that they are the divine revelation at Sinai.
Well, let's put it this way. I hope they're not, because if they are, then we have a nutcase for a creator, and that would be really bad news for all of us.
I think that's a terrible, vicious smear, and you may be judged for that.
Well, so be it. In terms of the book itself and reading it, I think that approaching it as this divine word rather than as a book that has wonderful things in it, that, like everything that is wonderful and loving and kind, is inspired, I believe, by God. On the other hand, to take the whole book and say we have to live by this book and somehow justify it, that to me is a disservice to the God.
I want to go on to another subject because you and I obviously disagree. I do look at the Bible as a blueprint for how we are to live. Now, Patrick and I have debated from time to time, and it's an issue, one of these issues that comes up around the edges of some of our conversations on faith, that there's a conspiracy to make Christianity, capital C Christianity, the religion of the United States. And as, when I say Christianity, I'm not talking about stands on various moral questions,
sure,
which transcend any religion, questions of life and death, death penalty, abortion, etc. Those are things that are going to be debated by any government. They're moral questions. I'm talking about a theological state where you have people having to take a loyalty oath to Jesus, and that only people who believe in Jesus can be citizens, or I don't know exactly how it would manifest, but there have been comments made on this program and comments made amongst my liberal friends that think that American congressmen and senators are secretly sitting around in wood-paneled rooms with antlers on the walls drinking scotch and talking about how to implement a Christian theology here.
Are they or aren't they? I am not a conspiracy buff or theorist, and I don't believe that for a minute.
Okay.
I mean, it sounds very far-fetched and crazy to me. On the other hand, when you have groups specifically aimed at informing Congress and changing their opinions to make them more in tune with the Christian ethic, like C Street and the Fellowship and the Family, all these different names that it flies under, there's nothing wrong with it, but they definitely have a proselytizing agenda that if they're in their best of all worlds, every congressman would be a Bible-believing evangelical Christian and would legislate accordingly. And they have every right to do that. But on the other hand, it would be naive to say that C Street and so forth don't have an agenda.
No, they do. But the point is that their agenda is that they derive their moral code from the Bible. And also, we could look at J Street right down the street, which is a left-wing group that's trying to knuckle the administration into recognizing a Palestinian state. Now, they have a right to do that, too. And I may disagree with it. But the point is, you've always got people who are involved with, who are animated by their religious beliefs, even if that religious belief is atheism, I just want to clarify that there's not a conspiracy. Therefore,
there's nothing like that. Listen,
Patrick?
Anybody that reads Sex, Mom, and God will know that there's no book further away from any conspiracy theory or grand theory than that book. It's just the opposite. I'm talking about many individual lives where the choices coalesce into political movements that you see coming out of the Republican far right these days. They have real impact on our culture. A lot of those folks are well-meaning people. The only people who are laughing all the way to the bank is corporate America that's now thoroughly deregulated and being able to do whatever they want to do, including taking secret campaign contributions, because You have an evangelical movement in this country that's the heartbeat of the Republican Party, and they're so suspicious of anything initiated by the government that they're just automatically against everything, including even Amtrak.
Well, wait a minute, Patrick, before you come in, I just want to respond to this.
They don't
even
want
the
infrastructure.
What is the connection? I think that what you're talking about here, when you talk about so-called unfettered capitalism, I don't know if that's necessarily a Christian thing. I think that's more the Ayn Rand libertarian movement, which is anti-Christian. She was
a
radical atheist, and people like Robert Rubin, we talked about Goldman Sachs. These people aren't Christians or into.
Right.
I mean, they would be the lost people. They probably don't. I doubt if they believe in anything. They're internationalists.
I completely agree with you. In fact, there's a whole passage in the book that says that, and I say.
But you just linked them.
What I'm saying is the only people who are laughing all the way to the bank are people who are taking advantage of a voting bloc of social conservatives who never actually see any change in the policies.
I agree
with you on that. For instance, on abortion for 40 years, but then they keep people in power whose real agenda is to make sure that Wall Street is unregulated and that the fat cats that where 1% of the population now owns 50% of the wealth
continue to
be able to do that.
But it's not a Christian thing, and they also are keeping abortion alive, too. Anyway, we're going to go to commercials. We'll be back.
Sunshine.
The Cyber Station USA.
We're
there. Greetings.
Hey, who said that?
That would be me, sir. And I'm down here.
Whoa.
Did you know that with Greyhound super friendly fares, you can travel to thousands of places in the U.S. starting at just $49 when you plan ahead?
Well, I gotta say, I'm in total disbelief here.
What's not to believe, sir? Greyhound fares have always been friendly on your wallet.
Oh, no, man, that's not what.
What is it then?
You're a dog.
You can't trust a cat to handle a mission like this, sir.
Special conditions apply. Call Greyhound for details.
I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called the Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question, but there's only one place. The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Catch us weekdays at 6 p.m. on CyberStationUSA.com.
Greetings.
Hey, who said that?
That would be me, sir. And I'm down here.
Whoa.
Did you know that with Greyhound super friendly fares, you can travel to thousands of places in the U.S. starting at just $49 when you plan ahead?
Well, I gotta say, I'm in total disbelief here.
What's not to believe, sir? Greyhound fares have always been friendly on your wallet.
Oh, no, man, that's not what.
What is it then?
You're a dog.
You can't trust a cat to handle a mission like this, sir.
Special conditions apply. Call Greyhound for details.
The UFOs, the things that go bump in the night.
I actually get goosebumps.
I think it's very, very important work.
This is Don Eckert, host of Duck Matters Radio, heard right here on CyberStation USA.
I do believe the government is covering something up.
I know what I experienced is real.
Why they're here, where they're from, you can only speculate.
Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. until midnight Pacific time on CyberStation USA.
This is Rare Power to Rearrange the Blueprint of Life.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
You are listening to The Fairness Doctrine on the CyberStation USA Radio Network. Chuck, take it away.
Patrick, I want you to get into Weird Edgewise.
Thank you. We also have some emails, too. Well, I was very glad to hear you make the point, Frank, that who says the Bible is the holy word of God and who says that God even uses words? That always irks me when I deal with religious people who say, but it says in the Bible, you know?
That's a circular argument. It's like Richard Nixon saying, I'm the best candidate. How do you know? Because I say so. You know,
right,
unless
yeah.
you can argue from a source outside of the source you're discussing, you don't have an argument.
That's right.
It's self-evident.
I was also interested in your point. pointing out that the evangelical crowd, which according to the Pew poll is about 23% of the country, and used to be 33%, I think they've gotten, for some reason, it's gone down to maybe demographics. The evangelical crowd, I think, is behind the Republican war on women. Would you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the lines that I trace through Sex, Mom, and God, whether it's talking about my personal experience as a child in a fundamentalist family or the politics that we took place in the 70s and 80s that my dad and I had so much to do with, you know, the election of Ronald Reagan, the first Bush presidency, et cetera, all of which we were in terms of gearing these guys toward the anti-abortion movement and thereby getting votes, you know, is predicated on the idea of quote-unquote traditional family values, which all sounds fine until you unpack the fact that one of these traditions is the subservience of women. And in fact, there's an enormous movement now in the U.S., numerically, has a lot to do with the evangelical homeschool movement called the Quiverful movement, where you've got people once again saying they will not use contraceptives, that a woman's place is, you know, literally pregnant and in the kitchen, subservient to men, raising daughters who are not allowed to drive as if they're in Saudi Arabia or something, right here in the U.S. Now, it's not every other person, but you see that, again, largely on the fringe, but a big fringe, you have a group of people who are trying to live out this ideal of women as second-class citizens. And, you know, they get it all from the Bible, or they think they do, and live accordingly. And so one of the things I talk about in Sex, Mom, and God is that if someone, you know, loves women, as I do my wife and my daughter and my granddaughters, at a certain point, that love is going to be on a collision course with what they're reading, not just in the Bible, but in that evangelical subculture that no matter what they say, and even though they reverence people like Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann, who say they're traditional family people and then become celebrities in their own right, nevertheless, the role of women within the evangelical community is one of subservience, certainly in the more right-wing aspects of it. And those are the folks demanding that the Republicans, quote-unquote, do something about abortion, do something about gay rights, all these other things. And traditionally, it's just been very anti-woman in its stance.
Frank, well, I want to ask you a practical question about that. Are they actually subservient? No, but I mean, you've made the comment that they are. I mean, does this actually translate out? I think that the more standard example of evangelical women is Sarah Palin and Phyllis Schlafly and Michelle Bachmann, and they're hardly subservient.
Well, actually, you make a good point, and I have to concede that, because my mother and the book, you know, Sex, Mom, and God, that's my mother I'm talking about, not only was a very powerful person in her teaching and her writing with a huge following, but even in her own life, in my own home, where my father was abusive of her and she had to stand up to him, you know, she cut a very powerful figure. And of course, many women have done that, but the fact of the matter is that when you look at the Quiverful movement, and anybody can go online and Google it, and you'll come up with a lot of stuff, a lot of articles, a lot of people living according to it, or Mary Pride, who I basically launched when I was her literary agent back in the late 70s and early 80s, and she started this whole evangelical homeschool movement with her book called The Way Home. You know, these folks preach stay at home, have babies, and it could be the 14th century or the 7th century or 1947. Now, there's nothing wrong with staying home and having children, and family is where it's at. I talk about my grandchildren and my children. That said, when you look at the agenda of the Republican Party today and its social program, especially in the area of abortion and also even family leave and medical care and these other things,
and
it impacts women's adversely. Yeah.
But is there evidence that they actually are subservient?
To stop birth control, too.
Yeah, no, the evidence is right in their own teaching. I mean,
are they actually? That's my question to you. I mean, how does this translate? And I think that the war on women is women having to pay 45% of their income in taxes. But putting that aside.
That's the war on the middle class.
Well, that would be nice, but I think that when you look at conservative religion worldwide, whether it's girls not going to school in Afghanistan or people in the Quiverful movement right here in the United States telling their daughters that they shouldn't drive and should stay home and obey their fathers and prepare to marry somebody, don't go to college because they might change your ideas or take you away from the Lord, there is a strain of crazy misogynistic right-wing Christianity. Of course, it's not where most Americans live, but it does have an effect on politics, because when you have people in Congress who are trying to mollify their radicalized right-wing base, whether it's the Tea Party folks on the libertarian side or their evangelicals on the anti-abortion crusade, they're pandering to them, and they pander to them by trying to shut down people like Planned Parenthood.
We've got a whole bunch of emails, Chuck. Do you want to listen to
them? Oh, okay. And I don't know anything about the Quiverform movement, but I'll look into that.
Look it up.
I will.
I don't think you'll like it any better than I do.
Yeah, but I just wonder if it really means...
We may actually agree on this.
Well, we'll see. I mean, what they're about and how influential they are and all that good stuff. But, Patrick, why don't we go to the emails?
Let's see. Mike from Maine. What has been the biggest change you have seen in the religious right over the years, and why does the religious right have so much power and influence and support?
The biggest change is the victimology. They have become people like Sarah Palin with her stuff about lamestream media, acting as if there's this big, bad, nefarious liberal conspiracy against them. And that's in spite of the fact that with George W. Bush in the presidency for 8 years, with the control of Congress off and on for the last 40 years, with a whole social agenda, they have been in charge, you know, including Fox Television Network that is three times the size of MSNBC and CNN put together. So these are not victims. They are a major force in the country, if not running big chunks of it. Certainly the business aspects of America follow there. This idea of victimhood is just a crock, and that's one of the changes. They've managed to be in control of big swaths of our culture and at the same time portray themselves as a minority victim at the mercy of the New York Times, and it isn't so.
They all do that, Frank. I mean, both sides have the victim, mythologies, and I agree with you in that. But, I mean, Fox is not as big as ABC, CBS, and NBC. Patrick?
Let's see. This is Jane from San Francisco. You talk about Sarah Palin and other women in the religious right and the Republican Party, but aren't they really saying, do as I say, not as I do, and they're essentially hypocrites?
Yeah, absolutely. And it started with, you know, if you look, for instance, at my mom, that I talk about in the book very glowingly, it's a tribute to her, but, you know, she would give all these talks on traditional marriage, then jump on a plane and go talk to the next big audience about it and sign books. And then you have Mary Pride, who started the whole homeschool movement, and then you've got Sarah Palin and Michelle Bachmann, and then a host of evangelical celebrities that are running around talking about traditional family, but living anything but themselves. It applies to the people that stand in line all night to get a book signed. It does not apply to the author.
Sounds like they're very empowered women to me.
Which is great. It's just too bad that if you read their book, you are disempowered.
I don't know
and
about
then
that.
Sandy from Ohio, the Sandy F. from Ohio, says, if the Bible is not the word of God, how are we going to know what God wants of us?
Well, maybe by looking into your grandchild's eyes and maybe by taking care of the people in your life and maybe by picking through the Bible itself and many other books as well and finding those things that respond to your better angels, to your best instincts. Maybe by looking at history and culture and science and trying to do a little thinking rather than looking for one silver bullet that will solve all your problems.
Frank, we've reached the end of the show again. Sex, Mom, and God, Frank Schaefer. Thanks, Frank, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much, guys.
All right.
Thank you, Frank.
Bye.
You're listening to The Fairness Doctrine on the CyberStation USA Radio Network. Stay tuned. Much more left in hour two.
Your eyes looked from your mother's face. Wildflower seed on the sandstone. May the four winds blow you safely home. Roll away, the dew. Roll away, the dew. Roll away, the dew. Roll away, the dew.
Fuse the old ways with the best ways of doing those things forever.
The future of radio.
Yeah, we're there, sunshine.
CyberStation USA.
We're there.
Greetings.
Hey, who said that?
That would be me, sir. And I'm down here.
Whoa.
Did you know that with Greyhound Super Friendly fares, you can travel to thousands of places in the U.S. starting at just $49 when you plan ahead?
Well, I gotta say, like, I'm in total disbelief here.
What's not to believe, sir? Greyhound fares have always been friendly on your wallet.
Oh, no, man, that's not what...
What is it, then?
You're a dog.
You can't trust a cat to handle a mission like this, sir.
Special conditions apply. Call Greyhound for details.
I'm Peter Anthony Holder, and I would like you to join me for a very eclectic and different kind of radio show. It's called the Stuff File Program. Where else would you get to hear a well-renowned Hollywood acting teacher, a best-selling science fiction writer, a guy who teaches llamas how to be golf caddies, or the man who has Hitler's toilet, all wrapped up with some of the oddest news stories around? It's a rhetorical question. But there's only one place. The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Catch us weekdays at 6 p.m. on CyberStationUSA.com.
Greetings.
Hey, who said that?
That would be me, sir. And I'm down here.
Whoa.
Did you know that with Greyhound's super-friendly fares, you can travel to thousands of places in the U.S. starting at just $49 when you plan ahead?
Well, I gotta say, like, I'm in total disbelief here.
What's not to believe, sir? Greyhound fares have always been friendly on your wallet.
Oh, no, man, that's not what...
What is it, then?
You're a dog.
You can't trust a cat to handle a mission like this, sir.
Special conditions apply. Call Greyhound for details.
From UFOs to things that go bump in the night.
I actually get goosebumps.
I think it's very, very important work.
This is Don Ecker, host of Dark Matters Radio, heard right here on CyberStation USA.
I do believe the government is covering something up.
I know what I experienced is real.
Why they're here, where they're from, you can only speculate.
Monday through Friday, 10 p.m. until midnight Pacific time on CyberStation USA.
This is Rare Power to Rearrange the Blueprint of Life.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Ladies and gentlemen,
the Fairness Doctrine, left-right radio for the radical center.
I'm Chuck Morse.
I'm Patrick O'Heffernan.
And, of course, the caliber of guests we're getting quite used to having on this program.
I really do enjoy this new platform.
Hello, sports fans.
Hi, again.
Intelligent conversation.
I'm on the conservative side.
Oh, boy.
The Fairness Doctrine starts right now on CyberStationUSA.com.
Hour number two of the Fairness Doctrine, left, right, and uncensored at CyberStation USA Radio Network. Chuck Morse along with Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan. Patrick, how are you?
Not bad, not bad at all. I'm still digesting the last interview, and he's really good.
Boy, does he know how to talk.
I enjoy talking with him.
Yep, he knows his stuff, that's for sure.
Well, he was part of it. I mean,
very anti-Bible.
One of the reasons we are the way we are.
I don't know what we really didn't get into, and Lars brought this up, how it is that he turned on his faith. I mean, we didn't ask that. I mean, that's always a question. I would ask that of a former communist, too.
Well, he didn't turn on his faith. His mother, did you read the book?
No.
Oh, well, read the book.
I read the beginning of it. I just couldn't. It wasn't my kind of a book. I mean, I, and I'll admit that. Well, I actually gave it to Mike Iwanowitz.
Well, that'd be interesting to hear what Mike has to say. His mother, he continued asking his mother questions about the contradictions in the Bible and contradictions between what evangelical leaders were saying and what their personal life was like. Particularly because he grew up with Billy Graham and all that family, and he pointed out this one of the most dysfunctional families he'd ever known, and his mother kept coming back with answers that didn't make any sense, and finally she kind of let him begin to explore on his own, and he began to look beyond the little closed world of evangelical Christian leaders for answers to the questions that he was asking. And very slowly, he began to see that in his opinion, everything he had been taught by the evangelical Christian community that he was in the center of was wrong. And that's so. He didn't turn against it. It was slowly an evolution that was part of his constant conversations with his mother. And his mother is really a fabulous person.
That caused him to turn.
Just reading about his mother is worth the book.
And I appreciate that, Patrick, because I didn't get a copy of the book to read. But after hearing the interview today, I definitely want to take a look at the book and get a chance to read it.
Well, you know, Patrick, you could say that about people who leave any movement. Like, for example, one of my personal heroes is Whittaker Chambers, who wrote his autobiography is called Witness, and it's how he left communism. But one of the things he mentions in the beginning of the book is that a young friend of his, who also left communism after having grown up in it all her life, what happened was she was in Moscow. She was about 21 years old, visiting, you know, the great and glorious leader, and she was in a hotel. And all of a sudden, she heard a scream. And there was something about that piercing scream in the middle of the night that changed her and woke her up to what she suddenly came to believe and understand was the truth of communism, and it led to her break with communism. So I'm just interested in anyone who grew up in a very rarefied faith and how they, you know, what it was that was the pivotal event that led them to break from it. And I'm not saying that necessarily to be judgmental, because I think oftentimes it's good to break. But as far as his going to his mother and asking her about contradictions in the Bible, she's not in a position of experience to have answered those questions. She should have had him go to a rabbi or you know, somebody who really knows the Bible and who could have explained and discussed the depth and the nuances of the Bible, rather than try to throw out some answer to those questions. And as far as the contradictions in the lives of Billy Graham, you know, the Bible teaches that we're imperfect, that we're made in the image of God, and that we can look to the Bible as a blueprint for how to aspire and order our lives, but that we're fallen angels. That's not a contradiction in Christianity. I mean,
that's your opinion. You didn't read the book, so you really
No, but I'm talking about what's in the Bible. The Bible, it's not a contradiction to be a sinner, in other words. I mean, it's understood that that is part of human nature. That's not, you know, we can all aspire to be better, but nobody really achieves that. I mean, that's, for him, and it also reminds me of, you get those stories amongst religions of all types. Like, for example, my great-grandmother broke from Judaism because she was angry over the fact that her father became sick on the Sabbath and refused to see a doctor, and he died. So she blamed Judaism for that. She said, well, I mean, because this ridiculous religion that won't let people call a doctor on the Sabbath, you can argue that maybe it was wrong. And it probably was. She probably should have called the doctor. There would have been nothing against Judaism if she had. But she blamed the religion. And that's what happens oftentimes. People, you know, there's something that goes on in their life and they blame the religion for it, when in fact it's their own dysfunction. Anyway, we're going to introduce our affiliates.
It has nothing to do with the person we just had on.
No.
This is Rare Power to Rearrange the Blueprint of Life. This is CyberStationUSA.com. Ladies and gentlemen, this is the Fairness Doctor. I'm Chuck Morse.
I'm Patrick O'Heffernan. Welcome to college.
CyberStation USA Radio Network.
The Fairness Box and left-right radio for the radical center.
Patrick's on the authoritarian left. I'm on the conservative side.
The stage was set for a battle that would pit friend against friend and neighbor against neighbor.
We have a glassed-in studio here.
What we're talking about is a balance back and forth.
Political points of an issue, as wholesome as apple pie and motherhood.
Like, left, it doesn't really matter. Look at the politics, the issues, and the culture.
It's like a civil war within the community. There's no question.
They're just going to be everywhere.
So here they are, ready to go for broke, right by your side.
Fairness Doctrine starts right now.
CyberStation USA Radio Network.
Welcome aboard. You're listening to the Fairness Doctrine, left, right, and uncensored at CyberStation USA Radio Network. I'd like to welcome WDIS AM 1170, WWPR AM 1490 in Bradenton, Florida, and KRKQ FM in Ashland, Oregon. The Fairness Doctrine, left, right, and uncensored, Monday through Friday, 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Chuck Morse, along with Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan, emanating from Los Angeles. Patrick, how are you?
I'm emanating away in the sunshine of Los Angeles and enjoying the interviews we have, and also the interview we have coming up. We're going to be talking with Tom Palkin about the increasingly interesting Republican lineup of candidates and non-candidates who might be candidates or who might not be candidates. So,
right. No, he's always good.
Good show.
Yeah, you bet. What else is new, Patrick, unless you want to talk some more about Frank Schaeffer's book?
Well, there's a lot of things that are new, but there's something going on here in California that I'm I haven't quite figured out yet, and that is the, you know, we have a budget process here, and the governor has assembled a budget that includes both revenue and budget cuts, fairly serious budget cuts. One of the budget cuts is to the university system, and another one is the closing of the parks. And Republicans here have been screaming about the parks for years. They say that the state shouldn't be operating parks, that parks should be privatized and turned over to corporations and charged admission for, et cetera. And when the governor finally released a budget that showed he was going to close 92 parks in order to save money, the private sector hit the ceiling. It turns out that the parks generate tens of hundreds of millions of dollars worth of revenue for the private sector and the movie industry. The movie right. industry came down and said, wait a minute, we use those parks constantly, and if you close those parks, we're going to move our industry or a lot of our shooting to Canada and other states. And so now there's this the Republicans are trying to figure out a way not to admit they were wrong and yet change their position on the situation. And it's kind of interesting to watch them tie themselves into rhetorical knots, backing down on their demand that we close all these communist parks while not saying that we should close these communist parks. So it's kind of fun
to watch.
Well, I
thought you said that they said they should privatize them, not close them.
Well, privatizing has the same impact. First of all, when you privatize something, that means you're giving away the public assets to a private corporation, and that's
right.
illegal unless you sell it to them. Nobody.
Well, I didn't say give it to them. You know, they could either sell it to them or lease
right.
it to them. And if you say that they're generating billions of dollars, why would they want to do that?
Hundreds of millions. Well, because there is a peripheral industry of motels and tours and restaurants
sure.
and camping gear and fishing guides and all this stuff that have sprung up around the parks, and that industry says if you close the parks, you know, we'll go out of business, and if you privatize the parks, that is, if you sell them to somebody big enough to spend the kind of money that the public assets are worth, they'll want to do all that stuff, and they'll put us out of business, too.
Although, on the other hand, we have a couple of cases in Massachusetts where a private park was transferred to ownership was transferred to the private businesses around it, or at least a public park, and they do a much better job of running it. Now, we're talking here about some very small, you know, minor parks, but nevertheless, they had a self-interest in keeping it open, and they actually run it. And, I mean, there's definitely another way. I mean, if these parks are good parks and they're productive, you know, it seems to me that somebody could put on their thinking cap over there and figure out a way to transfer it either to a private company or to a group of companies that benefit from it.
Well, fortunately, these are the public's assets. They're not there for private companies to make profits out of. They're there to be available to the people for free.
It sounds like they're getting rid of them, though.
For dozens and dozens of years, and the majority of Californians say, absolutely not. We own them. They're ours.
Well, then why is Brown getting rid of them?
He's not getting rid of them. He says he's going to close them temporarily in order to reduce the maintenance cost on them. And there are some other ways. One of the ways is in which people are volunteering to take over that maintenance themselves.
Well, that's right. But I'm just saying there are other ways, and one of them could be to privatize it, and they could be much better run, if anything.
No, they couldn't be. Actually, the few cases we've had of privatization that gone on in parks has been one in Yosemite, in which the center of the park has been turned over to private corporations, and about 15 years ago, they were destroying the inside of Yosemite, and the Park Service got clamped down on them and said, no, from now on, we're going to regulate
I thought that's
you.
A
we're
national park.
You what you can do. The trouble with private, first of all, Chuck, these are public assets.
I thought it was a national park,
Patrick. We can't turn over everything that belongs to the
people. I understand that, and I don't think we should, but I thought Zion was a national.
Private corporations don't. We have to take a break. We have to get
I was going to say, I'm going to hold you guys right there. We'll be right back.
Okay.
You're listening to the Fairness Doctrine on the CyberStation USA Radio Network. When we come back, we got Tom
Polkin.
Stay tuned.
Power to rearrange the blueprint of life.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
True facts. That is what you'll get from me. High-profile investigations, deadbeat parent cases.
Please welcome correspondent John Lieberman.
You've seen me on America's most wanted. Now you will hear me on CyberStationUSA.com. We're going to talk to the police, authors, and this is Great Star. We report interactive, call in, webcam in.
Detective Campbell wasn't satisfied with Brooke's story.
What is going on at our borders? True facts every Thursday night. Unlike anything on radio right now. CyberStationUSA.com.
On the line with me is Bill Konigsberg, father of two, Geico auto insurance customer. Bill, you saved money with Geico, enough to put your kids through college?
Well, no.
But your kids will benefit, right?
I guess.
You heard it. Parents who love their children switch to Geico. If you'd like to see the light in a young child's eyes, not to mention possible savings of 15% or more, call 1-800-947-AUTO. 1-800-947-AUTO. Geico Direct, the sensible alternative.
You cannot be serious.
There is a rational debate out there.
The Coincide, CyberStationUSA.com. It's one thing to be partisan. It's one thing to have your bias and your point of view. We're actually going to take people to task. We're going to take an honest look at all the pressing issues today. We're going to hold people accountable. We're going to call them out. There is common ground to be found. The Coincide, real political debate. Mondays, 12 to 1, live Eastern at CyberStationUSA.com.
If you're a talk radio fan, and I'm sure all of us are, after all, we're all participating as we speak, you're going to want to get a copy of my autobiography, Power Talk, The Influence of Talk Radio. This is Mike Siegel. We all know the impact talk radio has had over the years. Many of us would be voiceless without having had talk radio have impact on public policy decisions. And you and I have worked together over the years on many campaigns to change public policy. Get a copy at CyberStationUSA.com, either an ebook or hard copy, CyberStationUSA.com.
CyberStationUSA.com.
Through those means, a broadcast radio providing basic needs for one person for several days.
You're listening to The Fairness Doctrine on the CyberStation USA Radio Network with Chuck Morris and Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan. Patrick, or Chuck, take it away.
Thank you, Oz, and let me welcome aboard Tom Polkin. He's a friend of this program, the author of Bringing America Home, regular guest. Tom, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
It's great to be with you, Chuck and Patrick.
Tom, we obviously have a national election shaping up next year. First, I want to look at the presidential race. Is there enough energy? Is there enough money? Is there enough interest to beat the incumbent president, Barack Obama, next year?
Well, I don't think money's going to be the controlling factor, and I do think there's enough interest. The problem is that if you would ask most conservatives that I talk to, who's your favorite candidate at the moment, it's none of the above, winning by a large margin. So there is not satisfaction with the existing field. These are fine men and women, but nobody has really caught on, and nobody has emerged as someone who could, in a way, put back together that conservative majority we once had and we lost in the post-Reagan period of American politics.
So then there's no real movement conservative among the candidates, that at least none that people would latch onto? And also, is this a movement conservative year? I mean, is there
It is a movement conservative year if we get it right, because if you think back to Jimmy Carter, but for Jimmy Carter defeating Gerald Ford in 1976, I don't think a movement conservative like Ronald Reagan would have had a chance to win the nomination and be elected president. The mood is right for a conservative candidate who can appeal to the majority of Americans, but if it's just a conservative candidate going through the talking points that reaches 40% of the people, then that's not going to do us much good. And I think that's one of the biggest problems we face. There's some, a good conservative candidates in the race, but I don't think they're framing the debate in the right way to lay out an alternative vision to the Obama liberal policies.
Now, okay, our guest is Tom Polkin. Yeah, what would be the basic tenets of a conservative candidacy this next year. Let's just say if we exhumed Ronald Reagan and we had a Reagan-like figure for 2012, what would they look at in terms of issues that would resonate?
Well, one thing that I don't think our people are focusing enough on, I mean, I understand the need for austerity in these tough times, but a pro-growth economic policy that would bring jobs home to America, rebuild the manufacturing base, and grow the private sector. I mean, even the figures out today showing a very little growth in private sector employment for the month of May. We're stuck at a 9% unemployment. And that's the official rate nationally. I think it's much higher unofficially. So, number one, a pro-growth economic policy. Number two, addressing the waste and the fraud and the fact that you've got too much power and control by the Washington bureaucracy, figuring out a way how to send the power and the money back to the states and local communities and letting people closest to the scene determine how best to spend those dollars to address the needs out there. I think a foreign policy that returns to essentially what the Reagan policy was, one guided by our national interest, that is also very prudent about and cautious about sending American soldiers abroad only when they are, you know, only when our national interest is involved. And I think that that's very different from the Bush policy, which in a way has been continued by the Obama administration. And finally, I would say a recognition, if you will, of those traditional values of a strong work ethic, patriotism, the importance of strong family values, the kind of the cultural framework which needs to be rediscovered in this country. So I think those are the elements of an appeal that would reach the majority of Americans, and I'm not sure that at the moment any of our existing candidates are putting all of those elements together in a coherent message.
Patrick, let me welcome aboard my co-host, Dr. Patrick O'Heffernan. Patrick.
Thank you, Chuck, and thank you for being with us, Tom. You always have some very insightful and interesting things to say, and I hope that as we move through this campaign, we can call upon you for your insight every now and then. Yet the Republican lineup now seems to expand and contract and come into focus and go out of focus quite rapidly. Is Palin running?
I'd be surprised. I mean, you know, if she does. Obviously, she's on a national tour, but, I mean, looking at the numbers out there, is it better for her to be a voice, you know, from outside, sort of motivating people to get involved as opposed to going through that rather messy situation that you get embroiled in once you're a presidential candidate? So I'd be a little surprised if she got in the race. But, I mean, there have been so many surprises so far that it's hard to predict what anybody's going to do. But I think she'd have a tough time winning the election. But she's a very strong force at the grassroots level.
Is Michelle Bachmann running?
I think so.
I think so, too.
Yeah, she's already said she is.
Yeah. Well, she said she was. She made an announcement that she was going to announce.
She's going to announce in June, but she's making all of the steps to run, and she's trying to, if you will, win the support of the Tea Party, and she's already, I know, she's already out hiring people or at least talking to people about coming to work for her in Iowa, which is the first state. So clearly she views Iowa, which is next to her state and where she was born, as an opportunity for a breakthrough for her.
Okay. You said that you think this is a year for movement Republicans. I see some indications out there that this is exactly the wrong year for movement Republicans. The movement Republicans, I think, overreached in the Ryan budget, and they got slapped down real fast in the New York 26 election. And now we see polls that show that 7 of the 8 Republican governors are now, polls said of the 7 of 8 current Republican governors that if they had it all over again, they would not vote for those people. They would vote for Democrats. We're getting some voters' remorse on electing movement Republicans. So I don't think this is a movement Republican year at all.
Let me explain what I mean, and I think you raise a very good point. I think that our folks in Washington are going about it the wrong way. I mean, I would have led with a pro-growth economic policy and would say we got to get people back to work and we got to change the way we tax business in order to level the playing field with our trading competitors and bring jobs home to America. For whatever reason, they didn't go in that direction. Secondly, I think that if you look at it issue by issue, we could have had a better approach by, in a way, dealing with Medicaid by itself, which, I mean, is going to bankrupt states. I don't care whether you're a Democratic governor or Republican governor. Send it back, block grant it back to the states with the money, send the money with it, but let them make the determination about how to handle Medicaid. I mean, Rhode Island got a waiver, and they're doing better than a lot of other states. So that's an issue. There are issues that I think that a majority of Americans would agree on, and I'm not sure we're framing the debate the right way. I mean, to the benefit of the Obama administration. So it's not the question of the failure of conservatism. It's kind of like what type of conservatism and what approach. And one of the arguments in my book, Bringing America Home, in the post-Reagan period, what passes for conservatism isn't true conservatism. So I would say that just because of what you mentioned, that does not mean that someone who offers a vision of hope, not just being against the Obama administration, someone could emerge that would be able to rally the movement conservatives behind him or her and also attract what we used to call the Reagan Democrats and independents, who are very volatile and can go back and forth. As you point out, they were against Obama and the Democrats last time. 2 years before that, they were against Bush and the Republicans. It wasn't voting for Obama, and it wasn't voting for the Republicans last time. It was vote against, and it could be a vote against the Republicans next time if they don't handle it the right way. So I'm not disagreeing with you, but I still believe this is an opportunity for a philosophical conservative to emerge and really attract the support of a majority of Americans.
Well, point well taken on that, and I agree with you that that could happen, that the right candidate with the right philosophy was able to put the message forth in the right way. That's a possibility, but there's a lot of ifs in there, and one of the ifs is because of the so-called movement or self-identified movement conservatives that have been elected to governorships, state legislatures, and the Congress, the actions they've taken, they came in saying they wanted to create jobs, and what they did was they launched a war against women, and as a result, we're now seeing that women are moving away from the Republican Party. And, of course, women have always been a Democratic constituency. They moved towards the Republicans in the last election, and now they're running away from the Republicans because of all the attacks on women's rights. That is a movement Republican
Are you talking about the abortion issue?
Well, the abortion issue, child care, and a variety, trying to redefine rape, a whole series of things. And
I don't know of any philosophical conservatives I'm aware of trying to redefine rape. I mean, clearly there's
an H.R. 1.
Well, I'm you know, all I can say is I'm not going to defend everything the folks in Washington have done. I've tried to testify on what I think ought to be the focus. Clearly, they haven't listened to me, so I'm not going to, you know, I would have taken a different strategic approach had I had any influence. I don't, obviously, but I'm not familiar with that particular issue. I can simply say clearly there is a divide. I mean, many of us believe that you've got to respect the life of the unborn, and I know that's an issue that's the people are split down the middle on, but I don't see that as an impediment to us doing well next year. The fact that most conservatives tend to be pro-life, I think the impediment is we've got to show that we can offer an alternative to put people back to work, that we're not going to fall in the trap of being the roll pushovers for the Wall Street crowd who have been in control with Robert Rubin, Goldman Sachs secretary Secretary of Treasury under the Clinton administration, and Henry Paulson, a Secretary of Treasury from Goldman Sachs in a Republican administration. We need to bring outsiders in into those positions, and the Republicans, I don't see our guys talking about that. We're Main Street conservatives. We're not part of the Wall Street crowd when Goldwater ran against Rockefeller or when Reagan ran against Bush in 1980, and we got to understand that. It's kind of a Main Street conservatism that reaches out to people. It's not a simplistic. It's not just, oh, we put this group together and that group together, the social and economic conservatives, and we got a majority. It's very complicated. There's a new Pew study on voting moods of the American people, and I think it reflects the complexity that's out there. But I think there's a real opportunity for a philosophical conservative to win the nomination and be elected president. But at the way we're going, you're probably right. We won't get there.
Well, I remember that Reagan was took the position of being pro-life, and I don't recall there being rhetoric about his being in a war against women. There probably was, in all fairness.
No, not really. There wasn't.
Really? And
yes.
But my question,
the issue,
Patrick,
is handled differently.
I see.
Yeah, just said, I remember him in the debate with Mondale say, I know that this is a difficult issue, but I've got to come down on the side of life. But he didn't. He was just laying out what his belief system was, and that's fine. I think people accepted it. Even those who disagreed with him on that issue, they agreed with him on other issues and voted for him.
Patrick, against my better judgment, I'm going to ask you, what exactly do you mean by House Resolution 1 being in favor of rape?
I didn't say that. I said it was redefining rape, and in the bill, which was actually an implementation a bill to restrict the implementation of the Health Care Reform Act, there was buried in it a section that said essentially, and I'm paraphrasing now, that a woman cannot apply for insurance reimbursement for rape if she was sexually assaulted after drinking too much or being given drugs.
Right.
She could apply if she was sexually assaulted after being physically assaulted. And women said, wait a minute, you mean you're saying that if a man gets us drunk or drops a pill in our drink and then takes us upstairs and rapes us, that isn't rape?
And well, I don't think that's what it says. It just says it's not going to have the government cover the costs. But we're going to take a break.
Of course we are.
Roll away.
Capitol Hill Insight is a radio program outlined and designed to talk about the comings and goings of our men and women on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., brought to you by GradeGov.com. Capitol Hill Insight is aired twice weekly, Monday at 7 p.m. and again on Friday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It really is the wave of the future. CyberStation USA Radio Network is a worldwide broadcasting system.
Hi, I'm Eric, and I'm assistant manager at Walmart in Jacksonville, Florida. One time, a customer wanted a piece of merchandise that we no longer carry. Luckily, I was able to make a couple of calls and get her exactly what she wanted. Thing is, I went through those changes because she was a customer, not because she was my mother.
Always go the distance for you.
Friendly service, low price.
If you're a talk radio fan, and I'm sure all of us are, after all, we're all participating as we speak, you're going to want to get a copy of my autobiography, Power Talk, The Influence of Talk Radio. This is Mike Siegel. We all know the impact talk radio has had over the years. Many of us would be voiceless without having had talk radio have impact on public policy decisions. And you and I have worked together over the years on many campaigns to change public policy. Get a copy at CyberStationUSA.com, either an ebook or hard copy, CyberStationUSA.com.
True facts. That is what you'll get from me. High-profile investigations, deadbeat parent cases.
Please welcome correspondent John Lieberman.
You've seen me on America's Most Wanted. Now you will hear me on CyberStationUSA.com. We're going to talk to the police, authors, and this is Gray Star. We report interactive, call-in, webcam in.
Detective Campbell wasn't satisfied with Brooke's story.
What is going on at our borders? True facts every Thursday night. Unlike anything on radio right now. CyberStationUSA.com.
CyberStationUSA.com.
Through those means, a broadcast radio providing basic needs for one person for several days.
You're listening to The Fairness Doctrine on the CyberStation USA Radio Network. Chuck, take it away.
Thank you. Anyways, we're talking about the upcoming election, the presidential election, the congressional election. And I think we've already gotten a taste for some of the demagogic language that's going to be thrown up. I guess my question would be, when are they going to play the race card?
Well, I don't know that.
I mean, we already know the war against women, which I think what you've described is not redefining rape, but that's awfully inflammatory language. But, you know, it just looks like it's if President Obama looks like he's losing, and I don't know if he's – I think that as an incumbent, he has an advantage. But if it does, if it looks like he's behind, it's going to get very nasty.
Right.
What can the Republican – I mean, can the Republicans at least present some kind of a you know, like what Newt Gingrich did back in 1994. Not that I'm supporting him as a presidential candidate. I'm not. But you know, the Contract with America. They came out with a book. They had a gathering on the steps of the Capitol. They presented several clear and concise positions that they would take as a united party, and it worked.
Well, I have had. A talk show host up in Iowa has had me on and likes my book, Bringing America Home, How America Lost Her Way and How We Can Find Our Way Back, which lays out what's gone wrong in the post-Reagan period of American politics and what we can do to find our way back. And I think that we've got to offer solutions. You talk about 94, yeah, they laid that out. But then after a while, they fell in love with the idea that big government was okay as long as they were in charge of it, and they got trapped in the earmarks and really lost their way in terms of their vision. Reagan, that's the difference between why Reagan worked, because, yeah, people were fed up with Carter and his policies, but Reagan laid out solutions, and one can agree or disagree, but he put in place Kemp-Roth Job Creation Act, which got passed with bipartisan support. He stuck with Paul Volcker in bringing inflation down, even though it would hurt him in 1982 and hurt the Republicans, that is, in 1982 elections, which it did, but he thought it was the right thing to do. He put a policy in place to win the Cold War, which I think was very successful, with very little loss of American military lives. And literally, we cut discretionary domestic spending the first Reagan term during a period of high inflation by almost 10%. So I think that the difference why Reagan is still everybody, I see a lot of Republicans claiming to say, oh, they want to go back to Reagan. Well, we got to go forward, not back, but they were against Reagan back then, and now they're big Reaganites. So the problem, the reason we were successful, we had a president who had a vision, and he brought enough independent, experienced, conservative outsiders who executed the plan and weren't there to get a cushy job as a lobbyist or play the game to get along with the political elite. So I think that's what the American people are looking at on both sides. I think there's a real opportunity to take a lot of the Obama vote away if we had the right candidate and the right approach, because Obama, what kind of change have we had? I mean, you know, he has the Tim Geithner, who was a protege of Robert Rubin as the Secretary of Treasury. He's got Bill Daley, who's replaced Rahm Emanuel, and Emanuel was a protege of Robert Rubin in the Clinton administration, and Daley comes from J.P. Morgan Chase. So you got the Wall Street guys driving the train, and Main Street Americans and taxpayers are paying the price. And why the Republicans don't pick up on this is beyond me. But so far, we haven't.
Patrick?
Well, I agree with you on that very much, and believe me, over on my side of the aisle, the blue side of the aisle, we are not happy with the fact that Wall Street has totally infested at least part of this this administration. The couple of other candidates I'd like to ask you about. Chuck has mentioned Herman Cain a number of times, and based on Chuck's recommendation, I went and did a little research on Herman Cain. Very interesting guy. What do you think of his chances? You know, right now he's polling, what, 2% or something, but he seems to come off pretty well when I see him.
Well, I heard he did I did not hear the or did not see the debate in South Carolina. I heard that he did very well. He's spending a lot of time in Iowa, and he seems to be popular up there. A little bit of a mixed reaction. As I talk to people, they say he gives a very good speech, but when they try to pin him down on questions about individual questions or the tough questions that any candidate are going to get, he gets very vague. I mean, here's a guy who's been in business his whole life, and now he's making a major transition. In my experience in the Reagan administration, some of the businessmen who came in or think you can just apply business principles to turning around the government, it's a very different dynamic. I mean, I think business experience is very helpful, but you also have to have some wise political hands, and I don't mean the inside the beltway type, but people who have some experience, know how to get things done, and that's what I worry about a little bit about him. But I mean, he's a very interesting candidate. He's obviously been successful in the private sector, and he's making some headway in Iowa, which is the first state.
He was also the chairman of the Federal Reserve of Kansas City.
Right. Yeah, and in fact, the guy who is the president of the Fed in Kansas City, he'd be my candidate to be Secretary of Treasury to replace Bernanke at the Fed, and that's a guy named Thomas Honing who has said, and I agree with him, if these financial institutions are too big to fail, they're too big. And he is not he's an Iowa native and a Midwest guy who is not I think falling into the Greenspan, Bernanke, Tim Geithner trap, and as a result, he's not too popular. He's dissented from Bernanke and previously from Greenspan. So that man is doing a fine job. I disagree with Herman Cain and his support of the TARP bailout. I think there was a better way to go that would have been much better for the American taxpayers than that bailout of the too big to fail financial institutions, where there was a huge transfer of wealth from particularly the AIG deal, $80 billion transferred to Goldman Sachs. They got $13 billion. European financial institutions and other American financial institutions, and they got paid 100 cents on their dollar for their risky credit derivative trades. That, to me, was outrageous, so I was very much opposed to the bailout.
Another candid question for you. Given that the American people are split right down the middle on pro-choice, anti-choice, could a
pro-abortion or opposition to abortion, depends on how, from your perspective.
You're right. Could a pro-choice?
The choice of a baby? You know, to be born.
Could a pro-choice candidate get anywhere in the Republican Party?
Well, that's a good question, and I think it's a little bit, you know, this is very interesting because the Democrats, Al Gore was originally pro-life, Jesse Jackson was originally pro-life, Dick Gephardt was originally pro-life, Ted Kennedy originally so, and they all switched as the Democratic Party became a litmus test. You had to be pro-abortion.
Can a pro-life candidate make it in the Democratic Party?
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
Good question.
And the same thing has happened. Look, George Herbert Walker Bush was pro-abortion rights and then switched when it became clear after Reagan that, or running in 80, that the pro-life position was much stronger in the Republican Party, and I'm not sure that was all that big an issue with George W. Bush, and I'm sure it wasn't a big issue with Karl Rove, his political guru, but they adopted the position for political reasons. So I think that it'd be very difficult for a pro-abortion rights candidate to make it through the Republican primary, although Mitt Romney, he was pro-abortion. He agreed with Ted Kennedy and when he ran for the Senate.
Pro-choice. Nobody's pro-abortion.
I don't think
pro-abortion.
You know,
pro-abortion rights. I should
actually.
Put it
I don't
way.
Think that having in Massachusetts. I don't think it's Mitt Romney wasn't pro-choice. What Mitt Romney said during the campaign for governor was that he would support the laws of Massachusetts as they existed, right. Even though he was not pro-choice.
Well, but he was in the debate when he ran for the Senate. If you see, you can see it on YouTube. The Kennedy. Kennedy-Romney debate, he was for, and I stand to be corrected earlier, he was pro-abortion rights or in favor of legalization of abortion at that time.
Well, abortion is legal.
Yeah, I know, because Roe v. Wade overturned all 50, the laws of all 50 states.
Well, sometimes that happens. The states can do unconstitutional things. The reason that I brought this up is partially because of Mitt Romney and also partially because of the attempt to defund Planned Parenthood.
Right.
A recent study published by The Hill showed that 60% of voters have a favorable view of Planned Parenthood, and 25% of all female voters in the country have sought care at Planned Parenthood clinics. And this seems to be another case of overreaching that's going to turn off an important constituency.
Well, I don't agree. I mean, if you what they're really addressing is Planned Parenthood's involvement as the leading provider for abortions in the U.S., and I don't think the taxpayer dollars should be used for that.
Well,
so
of course
I don't.
They weren't, but let's not go off into that issue.
Yeah,
let's stick with the elections here.
You know, you're doing it indirectly. I mean, it covers G&A. It's a big number, a big advantage for Planned Parenthood to get that kind of money. So if they want to disassociate themselves from as an abortion provider, it's a whole different question. But I don't think they will.
But you've got 30 seconds for our next break. Is that going to have an impact on the Republican primaries?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think the big issue is going to be job creation and economic growth and how do we fix the deficit. And part of it is grow the economy, and secondly, it is to return power and money to the states and take some cuts, but let the states and local communities determine how best to spend those discretionary domestic dollars.
We'll be back.
Wildflower seed on the sandstone. May the four winds blow you safely home. Roll away and do. Roll away and do. Roll away.
This is rare power to rearrange the blueprint of life.
This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Capitol Hill Insight is a radio program outlined and designed to talk about the comings and goings of our men and women on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., brought to you by GradeGov.com. Capitol Hill Insight is aired twice weekly, Monday at 7 p.m. and again on Friday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It really is the wave of the future. CyberStation USA Radio Network is a worldwide broadcasting system.
Hi, I'm Eric, and I'm assistant manager at Walmart in Jacksonville, Florida. One time, a customer wanted a piece of merchandise that we no longer carry. Luckily, I was able to make a couple of calls and get her exactly what she wanted. Thing is, I went through those changes because she was a customer, not because she was my mother.
We'll always go the distance for you.
Friendly service, low price.
Always.
If you're a talk radio fan, and I'm sure all of us are, after all, we're all participating as we speak, you're going to want to get a copy of my autobiography, Power Talk, The Influence of Talk Radio. This is Mike Siegel. We all know the impact talk radio has had over the years. Many of us would be voiceless without having had talk radio have impact on public policy decisions. And you and I have worked together over the years on many campaigns to change public policy. Get a copy at CyberStationUSA.com, either an ebook or hard copy, CyberStationUSA.com.
True facts. That is what you'll get from me. High-profile investigations, deadbeat parent cases.
Please welcome correspondent John Lieberman.
You've seen me on America's Most Wanted. Now you will hear me on CyberStationUSA.com. We're going to talk to the police, authors, and this is Gray Star. We report interactive, call-in, webcam in. Detective Campbell wasn't satisfied with Brooke's story. What is going on at our borders? True facts every Thursday night. Unlike anything on radio right now, CyberStationUSA.com.
CyberStationUSA.com.
Who knows me is a broadcast radio.
Providing basic needs for one person for several days.
You are listening to The Fairness Doctrine on the CyberStation USA Radio Network. Chuck, take it away.
Thank you, Lars. Our guest is Tom Palkin, and we're talking about the upcoming Republican field for president in 2012. Tom, I think ultimately the issue is going to come down to the price of hamburger.
Yeah, well, the price of hamburger, and also, really, are you going to have a job next year, or what kind of future opportunities are there for our kids and grandkids?
Right. I mean,
are they all going to work in the service industry? Are they all going to flip burgers or be at hotels? I mean, you know, we've hollowed out our manufacturing base. We lost one third of our U.S. manufacturing jobs, 5.5 million over the last decade.
Yeah, but none of the Republicans seem to be. I mean, except for Donald Trump, actually.
I am.
I know, Donald Trump brought it up, and he was criticized for it. And I'm not suggesting that I supported his candidacy, but nevertheless, he did wade forth into this issue.
Sure, no.
No one else is. And meanwhile, the president is having free trade deals with three more countries, and unemployment is continuing after 3 years to hover around slightly under 10%. Now we find out today that the General Motors bailout cost the taxpayers $14 billion. And Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have received another $6 billion in March. So, yeah, there doesn't seem to be a lot of movement. And I think that that's going to be the issue that will be the only thing, the only wedge issue that could end up resulting in a genuine change.
I concur, and I'm very disappointed that the Republican candidates aren't bringing this up. I mean, you know, they get fall on their sword over this illusion of free trade. Well, you know, if you look at our trading competitors, and we're running trade deficits with 90 nations, they have, by the way, they tax business to provide incentives for their domestic manufacturers. They've got, on average, an 18% tax advantage when they send goods in here versus when we try to send goods to their countries. Germany, which is a high-wage nation and has a high social structure cost, they have a 19% tax advantage over us. I mean, we're killing ourselves.
There's no one taking it up.
Well, I'm out there trying to at least wave the flag and maybe see if I can get somebody interested in taking up the issue. But I'm going back to Iowa next week and going to Newton, Iowa, where Maytag used to be a strong manufacturer, and those jobs have gone to Mexico.
Now they're in Mexico, Now, earlier this year, I mean, the Republican Congress, the Republican House, were able to prevent or at least raise enough issues to prevent the president from raising taxes at the end of 2010. Now they've been able to get a cut in the budget by really not that much, about $35 billion. And they're trying to ensure that there are more reforms that would be connected to a raising of the debt ceiling. You know, they're really, it seems to me that the other side is just pushing for more higher taxes and expanding the size of government, which is what they've always done.
But, well, actually, we're not, Chuck. We're pushing for higher taxes on the two-thirds of all corporations that don't pay any taxes.
I rest my case.
To mention that, Tom. And on wealthy people who pay an effective tax rate below the middle class, we've already cut.
Patrick,
just don't stop interrupting me. And we've already cut over 150,000 people from the federal payroll since Obama took office. We've also cut $6 billion from the public payroll. So this is a myth that Republicans are trying to push, that we're expanding government and raising taxes. No, we're not. We lowered taxes, too. If you'll recall, the Obama administration, in the first months, lower taxes on everybody in the country. The Obama administration has cut the federal workforce. It has cut the federal budget. It has lower taxes on the middle class. What we want to do now is to see to it that the two-thirds of corporations that pay no taxes, regardless of what the rate is, and Tom, you have to just put that in when you say that they have a tax advantage. They may have a tax advantage, but the corporations don't pay taxes. And on the wealthy people who only pay 15% on their capital gains taxes, while the rest of us pay 30% on our wages. We want working people to pay fewer taxes and wealthy people to pay more taxes, because that's the price of a democracy. So I totally reject this myth the Republicans are trying to put out there.
Can I speak now? I am in favor of, first of all, you've got to grow the private sector. And I don't disagree with you. By the way, GE, whose president is one of the president's top advisors, is one of those companies that's making a lot of money and paying no corporate taxes. What I am in favor of is totally replacing the existing system with a revenue-neutral 8% business consumption tax, which would be border-adjusted. That means all imports coming into the U.S. from overseas, including GE, as they have their factories overseas and send products back into the U.S., they'd have to pay an 8% tax on all those goods and services coming back into the U.S., and all companies exporting from the United States into other nations get an 8% tax credit on their 8% business consumption tax. It's revenue neutral.
I think that deserves a very serious study. I like the idea. It can't be revenue neutral, though, because we need to reduce the deficit. Oh, and by the way,
General
Motors paid $4.7 billion of its bailout money back.
Right.
Yeah, but they've cost the taxpayers apparently $14 billion. But, Patrick,
can I just ask something here?
Okay. Patrick, I mean, is the Democratic Party or the Democratic congressmen who are presenting bills to raise the capital gains tax and raise corporate taxes like you've just suggested?
I don't know if there are specifics. I do know that there is a people's budget that has been put forth by the organization that Dave works for that's now circulating in the Congress.
He should bring it to Capitol Hill. I'd love to see some from Democrats get behind raising the capital gains tax and raising corporate taxes. Let's see how far it goes in Congress.
Criticism is well taken. The Democrats have sat back and let the Republicans overreach through the Ryan budget.
Good. Well, then let them bring it up and let's see how it does. I'd love to see how Obama signs it, too.
Could I just add, revenue neutral simply means is not a loss in revenues. It means that by getting rid of the system, you're putting a new way of taxing business in place that's going to raise just as much revenues, if not more, than the existing corporate tax system. And in fact, I would argue over a period of time, by going to a business consumption tax that's border adjusted, that 8% not only is revenue neutral today, but that it will help grow. We'll see a growth in revenues as the jobs come home and we finally start growing the private sector again. We've had zero private sector job growth over the last decade in Democratic and Republican administrations alike.
You're factually wrong on that. The CBO has been reporting private sector job rate every month for the past 9 months. It has been reporting public sector job loss.
No,
Patrick, I can pull that data up.
I can give you the Bureau. Let me give you the Bureau of Labor Statistics figures as reported in the Financial Times from February 2009, when the Obama stimulus plan went into place, through May of 2011. The loss of private sector jobs, over and above what we lost over the last 10 years from 1999 through 2009, was 2.7 million additional private sector jobs. We are not creating any private sector jobs with the Obama stimulus plan. And I'm not saying it's just their fault. We didn't create private sector jobs when the Bush people were in, because they aren't focused on the loss of manufacturing jobs and the tax system, which incentivizes these multinational companies to ship jobs overseas. And they shipped 2.5 million overseas that they've increased over the last decade, while getting rid of 2.9 million jobs here in the U.S. That's 20% of the private sector. Those are direct jobs that have been lost. Imagine the indirect jobs that also are lost as a result.
Can argue over data at some other time. We haven't had a chance to talk about your book, unfortunately. And we're just about out of time, so you're going to have to come back on the show.
All right. I look forward to it. And the book, you can go to tompaukin.com, T-O-M-P-A-U-K-E-N.com, and can order the book from Amazon. But it talks about a lot of these issues. I'm not saying things on this show that I don't say in the book, and I blame the Republicans in the post-Reagan period as much as the Democrats for the mess we're in today, but we got to get out of it before it's too late.
Thanks a lot, Tom. Thanks for joining us.
Sure thing. Enjoyed it, gentlemen.
All right. Patrick, I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Yes, you will. Looking forward to it.
All right. You'll listen.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Stay tuned for Mike Siegel.
Thank you, and have a good evening.
This is Rear Power to Rearrange the Blueprint of Life. This is CyberStationUSA.com.
Capitol Hill Insight is a radio program outlined and designed to talk about the comings and goings of our men and women on Capitol Hill in Washington D.C. Brought to you by GradeGov.com. Capitol Hill Insight is aired twice weekly, Monday at 7 p.m. and again on Friday, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It really is the wave of the future. CyberStation USA Radio Network is a worldwide broadcasting system.
Hi, I'm Eric, and I'm assistant manager at Walmart in Jacksonville, Florida. One time, a customer wanted a piece of merchandise that we no longer carry. Luckily, I was able to make a couple of calls and get her exactly what she wanted. Thing is, I went through those changes because she was a customer, not because she was my mother.
Always go the distance for service, low price. Always at Walmart.
If you're a talk radio fan, and I'm sure all of us are, after all, we're all participating as we speak, you're going to want to get a copy of my autobiography, Power Talk, The Influence of Talk Radio. This is Mike Siegel. We all know the impact talk radio has had over the years. Many of us would be voiceless without having had talk radio have impact on public policy decisions. And you and I have worked together over the years on many campaigns to change public policy. Get a copy at CyberStationUSA.com, either an ebook or hard copy, CyberStationUSA.com.
CyberStationUSA.com.
Terrestrial radio is basically going to be supplanted by what's happening in technology. Think about this. Your internet receiver gives you the entire world. It's remarkable.
This is CyberStation USA.
True facts. That is what you'll get from me. High-profile investigations, deadbeat parent cases.
Please welcome correspondent John Lieberman.
You've seen me on America's Most Wanted. Now you will hear me on CyberStationUSA.com. We're going to talk to the police, authors, and this is Great Star. We report interactive, call-in, webcam in. Detective Campbell wasn't satisfied with Brooke's story. What is going on at our borders? True facts every Thursday night. Unlike anything on radio right now, CyberStationUSA.com.